It's Friday.
Yay.
Welcome to Two Way Talk here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM. Absolutely the voice of the community. I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And I'm Kara Williams.
It's Friday. Another week flew
this
by.
This week flew by.
It really did.
Yeah.
We had a great week.
Yes.
We had a great week.
And great guest.
Great guest. All week, just great conversations. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons it was so wonderful is that you, the listeners, were engaged in the conversations.
That is right.
So for the next 2 hours, just call right in at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Join the conversation. Every Friday, we have our news roundtable. We bring some of the brightest minds together as we discuss the headlines in the news for the week. Joining us this week, Jessie Mejia Terry. She is a Democratic strategist. Really, she's an international strategist as well, because I know she's worked on campaigns around the world. Jessie Mejia Terry, welcome to Two Way Talk.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm doing great.
How are you both?
Good, thank you.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. It's been a long time, but we're going to have you on again soon. You are really, I love picking your brain. You follow races around the world. We have a lot to talk about what's going on in Washington. I look forward to hearing some of your thoughts.
Thank you.
Paul Plymouth is a centrist-leaning Democrat in Baltimore City. As a graduate of the University of North Carolina School of Government, Paul is a Baltimore City Hall alum and has worked on various local and state election campaigns. Paul used his work and life experiences to analyze theoretical and practical policies and its impact on communities, businesses, and the society at large. Paul Plymouth, welcome to Two Way Talk.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Happy Friday. Glad to be on.
It's Friday. I love Friday. And then the final guest is Russell Neverdon, Esquire. He is a Morgan State alum, and he's a community advocate. Russell Neverdon, welcome to Two Way Talk.
Hey, thank you for having me. Happy Friday to everybody.
Happy it's great Friday. To have you on board. So, folks, let's just jump right in. Kara and I been picking issues that we wanted to talk about for this hour. One of the things, of course, is that the Democrats and the Republicans, in a rare bipartisan moment, passed the debt ceiling only until December the 3rd, but that means there will be no layoffs or shutdowns
right.
of the federal government. Let's start with you, Jessie. There was some talk that this was not going to happen.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
That was the talk, I think. It's been the talk for a couple of weeks now.
Definitely.
But I think with the debt ceiling, it's almost mutually assured destruction.
That's right.
if you mess with that, it's sort of one of the nuclear things that you do not want to get near.
You don't want to do.
Exactly. You don't want to get blamed for a shutdown, for people not going to work in the middle of a pandemic. You know, it would have been foolish for
yes.
them to not do that. Yes, last night.
Now, Paul Plymouth, as Jessie said, I remember Donald Trump letting the government shut down. It was not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
The Democrats were pointing the fingers at the Republicans. The Republicans were pointing the fingers at the Democrats. Everybody had ticked off the American people. Were you surprised that they reached the last minute deal?
I'm not surprised. It seems to be that over the past decade or so, that tends to be the tactic, particularly for Republicans, of, hey, we're coming up on that threshold. We can't cross it. We stand firm on that. But it's happened over Trump, and they even found some parameters to suspend it from 2019 to this
wow.
year.
Mm.
And there's a false narrative that's normally said of, hey, people can't increase their debt limit, so the government shouldn't be able to as well. I say that's false because while you and I can't do that, we also don't have the credit worthiness as well as the means of securing cash like the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So the better comparison case would be more like Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
Where if they need to raise the credit limit at any point in time, their debtors know that they're good on that.
They're good.
And we're good
that's
on
right.
that, too.
Now, Russell Neverdon, it seems to me that a lot of attention is played on both the Democratic and Republican side when it comes to lifting this debt ceiling. But a lot of people's day-to-day lives, paychecks, livelihood, really does rest on the federal government continuing to go forward.
Absolutely. This is really a posturing tug of war, if
yes.
you will. You've got the Democrats on one side who are still, truth be told, are still trying to push some social initiatives that Biden really wants to get passed and what we desperately need, because we've got some serious and significant disparities and ills, you know, from a societal standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But the Republicans at the same time are trying to use this as a means of leverage to say, hey, if you guys want to go, we're not going to let you do the social piece.
That's
but,
right.
But if you're going to move with expedience as quickly as you guys did to raise the debt ceiling, then you should be just as quick to push some of the things that are important to us with our agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Their biggest concern seems to be, how do we deal with and or address this $3.5 trillion proposed bill that's going to be used to deal with some threshold issues from a social perspective,
mm-hmm.
while at the same time, they're big, you know, we're talking about conservatives on one end who just there is about fiscal conservatism, just holding the dollar as tightly as it can, and we know what ends up happening with it from a Republican standpoint. It passes back through to those who already have money,
oh,
and it
yeah.
helps their pockets grow while the others are pretty much held hostage. And so in this instance, I'm glad they reached that, because really what we're talking about are Social Security benefits,
mm-hmm.
Retirement benefits, and other benefits that are otherwise would be going out or would be doled out normally, but people are going to end up really being impacted greatly or adversely. They've got to, this really, what sickens me about this is that we keep finding ourselves in the same position that we're going to kick the can down the road to get another 90 days out of it. And while they're posturing for things that really don't make, you know, a big difference when you're talking about the quality of life, which
mm-hmm.
is really what this comes down to. So this it's going to be interesting what happens when we get to December, because that's going to put us into the next year.
That's right.
Just several months out, just before the new fiscal has to come out.
And a whole lot of posturing yet again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kara, I thought about you because one of the things that I was talking to a former member of the legislature about yesterday, he said people really don't realize how important raising the debt ceiling is. Because when the federal government shuts down, one of the most impacted groups are veterans.
Yes.
The veterans' hospitals shut down and slow down. Services to veterans are cut. So they have to. He was saying, look, we've just got to raise this debt ceiling. Nobody wants the United States to be deeper and deeper in debt. But we've got to keep the federal government
yeah.
going.
And I was thinking about the same thing. I don't know if we read each other's mind or not, but I agree with what Jesse said at first. Nobody wants to have that responsibility.
Yep.
And I was looking at it like a volleyball game, and in the middle of that ball, it says veterans. I don't know
wow.
whether you are reading my mind or not, and they're just lobbying it back and forth over. And nobody wants to be responsible for that shot, that
mm-hmm.
losing shot, you know, and everybody lose their job, their benefits, and all that. Yeah.
I want to talk, Jesse, Paul, and Russell, I want to talk first and just get your general thoughts on this. We have a clip I want to play, but there seems to be the back and forth between Democrats and Republicans seem to, over the last 8 years, mm-hmm. and that's part of the last administration, Barack Obama and Donald Trump, seems like that divide in our country has gotten even worse.
Oh, yeah.
The American divide seems to have always been there. But the politicians in the Senate and the House, they have gotten more hostile. They've gotten more entrenched. Jesse, what can we do to get these people at the negotiating table more often than last-minute emergencies?
You know, Anthony, I'm not sure that mm-hmm. anything other than perhaps perhaps tackling the redistricting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
it might just get down to that granular level where you have to think about how these districts are drawn so that there's greater representation, a more fair representation, and that these districts do not just become hostage almost
yeah.
of whoever is the incumbent, and
mm-hmm.
and once you can free that up, once you can come to a more representative democracy. I mean, it sounds like such a cliche, right? But it's so true. If we could find a way to ensure that these districts really truly represent who is in those districts,
mm-hmm.
then perhaps we can get more level-headed people. And I don't, you know, I know that you know, I know where I stand on the fight, right?
Of course.
but I think we have, I mean, the last 4 years of Trump were no easy ride through the park. And the lasting legacy of it, if anything else, has been this really terrible divide in the country. And people are, you know, people who are emboldened to, you know, act a certain way and feel they have the right to certain things. And, you know, we've seen that play out, right, especially on January 6th. And so, you know, I mean, once you get to the point where you have a more fair representation, I think we can bring people with fair heads, cooler heads, can sit down on the table and negotiate what's actually good for the country. This, you know, it's so frustrating to see what they're doing in Capitol Hill right now when there, you know, there's so much at stake, And I heard the other day, it's transformational social spending.
Oh, wow.
Tax and environment, and it's a tax and environment package that will help us move on with more confidence in the future. And this is a Democrat, you know, what's happening in the Hill now, it's a Democratic-made drama. And
yes.
It's not necessary.
You know, Paul Plymouth, I do want to ask you, do you remember when Mitch McConnell was the majority leader of the Senate, and he said the day after Barack Obama was elected, he wanted to make Barack Obama a one-term president. He was going to kill anything that came from the Democratic president to the Senate. I think if you watch the Democrats in the House and the Senate now, they really have the same idea, although they have a Democratic president. There are certainly obvious things that they want to push through. The divide on the Hill has never been this deep.
Anthony, I do unfortunately remember that quote from Mitch McConnell. I remember those bad days. And like you said, it only continues to get worse.
It does.
And it's not just in Washington, but it continues to permeate out to the people, because that's what the media tends to cover. They don't cover some bipartisan action or even unanimous congressional actions. It's just on the divide. I think a potential solution, and this is kind of a long shot, but it's still something that's, quite frankly, it is ambitious, but it's still practical. If we expand something like what they identified as the Problem Solvers Caucus, where you had centrists on the left and centrists on the right, come together to talk about some issues. They came up with some COVID bills. They came up with some infrastructure ideas. And I think if you're able to pluck some from the far left and the far right to also participate in some of those talks, but those folks need to be action-oriented and smart enough to actually come to the table with solutions, unlike a Marjorie Taylor Greene that just wants to be an obstructionist at all times, then I think that you can get to a point where you can get good representation from all of Congress at the table to talk about issues. And as long as a majority of them, it's perfect if a consensus can come together, but if a majority can come together and put a rubber stamp on an idea or a policy, then it becomes a larger, conversation for the rest of Congress to move towards something. And perhaps it's going to be amended, perhaps, it won't be the exact same what the caucus came up with, but it becomes a more realistic conversation starter than when AOC comes forth with the Green New Deal, something that's looking to be very bold and ambitious and really change whole industries, old industries, within a short period of time. When you have something that has represented a buy-in and comes to the table with what are considered real solutions, those become more of a conversation starter and an action starter than something that's just too far to the left or to the right.
Russell Neverdon, it seems like Paul Plymouth is calling for common sense. There doesn't seem to be a lot on either side. There are times, Russell, when groups of Democrats and Republicans will get together like the Gang of Six or the Gang of Ten, where there's five Dems and five Republicans, and they are working on a piece of legislation to bring people together. It hardly ever seems like that works any longer. Why doesn't it work, Russell Neverdon?
Well, I think we're still dealing, as you kind of alluded to earlier, we're still dealing in a post-Obama era where the mindset and the mantra is still kind of consistent. Anything that even sounds Obama-esque, they're going to shoot down.
They're going to kill it.
But here's the thing that we really got to, I think, look to is, and one of the other subjects that I may be getting ahead, But this infrastructure bill is concerning to me.
Yes.
And I'll tell you why. Because it's not just the Republicans that we're having infights with.
Of course.
It's a division amongst the Democrats. And this is where that division comes in, which is why the party has to strengthen itself. Because you still have some who are kind of wavering on the fence, mm-hmm. who still believe in some of the social issues and agendas that have to be pushed. But that conservatism is coming out because, let's be clear, the infrastructure is critical. That's priority. It should have been a package deal because mm-hmm. that's what really gets the country moving. That's what puts people back to work. That's what helps us avoid these horrific potholes that we keep rolling over, bridges that are falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
Just the sheer number of people who are actually engaged, gainfully employed, and more important when we start talking about the minority participation, that there's been a commitment to elevate that to a certain level. That really becomes key and critical. So
Russell, never
really have to keep our eye open on that.
You have moved us forward before I was ready to move us forward, but you are 100% right. The divide that we see in Washington right now is among the Democrats. The progressives and the moderate Democrats are going at each other's throat. Nancy Pelosi is doing a juggling act, trying to keep everybody on the mm-hmm. same page, but the Democrats are falling apart. We have a clip I want you to listen to, and then we're going to get into it.
About the deficit, then maybe we go after our defense spending and find our savings there instead of going after people's child care.
I asked him today, is that his top line number? Would he go up? He said no. He is firm on $1.5 trillion. So would you be willing to come down?
You know what? Where are the investments? My question is, who is he saying? Who is he pinpointing? You know what? You all don't deserve the investment in climate. You all don't deserve 2 years of college. You all, who is he taking the money from? That's my question. Because let's be clear, 3.5 wasn't our number. You know, I was at the six, you know? And so when you take it down to 3.5 trillion, then you tell us, no, we won't even do that. We want to do 1.5. Mm-hmm. Who is it that you feel is so set up and stable and in a position to where they don't have needs, to where it's okay to make this decision? Because being clear, he does not need any of the resources that we're talking about. We have to support and make sure that resources are available for every person in our communities. How do you say that? So my question to him is, who are you saying should not have prescription drug coverage reform? Who is it that you're saying should not have these housing investments? What community like mine, number one for murder, number one for homicides in the country, you're telling us that we should not have the investment in community violence intervention, $5 billion. You're telling us no? That is my concern.
The two sides are really far apart at this point.
So there you have it. That was Representative AOC, mm-hmm. Representative Cori Bush, attacking Senator Joe Manchin. Mm-hmm. They said he wanted to cut the infrastructure bill down. They, in fact, wanted to go up. It almost seems, Jesse, that the divide between Democrats, between the moderates and the progressives, is almost more than Nancy Pelosi or anyone, including the Senate majority leader, they're going to be able to overcome in the near future.
I sure hope not. Because we definitely need that. You know, I am of the thought that we need that $3.5 trillion package. It's just too much at stake there. You know, what makes this a $3.5 trillion package is precisely the human infrastructure spending. You know, the stuff that we're talking about, the stuff that makes the child tax credit permanent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the families that are receiving $300, you know, working families that need that money, you're talking about making that permanent. You're talking about universal pre-K, tuition-free community college, funding for historically black colleges and universities, more Pell grants. That's just on the, you know, the human infrastructure.
Side. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, you know, there's the public housing piece with the banking committee and a few others. I mean, we're talking about tax increases that pay for this of the folks that are better off. And then, of course, addressing climate change, which, you know, it's everything right now. And so I don't understand why these two moderate Democrats are holding this up. And
mm-hmm.
I think Russell said it, it's so unfortunate that this drama is playing out just on the on the Democratic side between Democrats and between moderates and progressives, and these two senators that are holding this up, this not just Joe Manchin of West Virginia, but Sinema of Arizona.
Who,
from what I understand, and I'm trying to figure out what it is that they need, but can anybody figure out what these two want? Because I haven't, I can't. Where is what their request is?
Paul Plymouth, I want to ask you and Russell Neverdon weigh in on this. We only have a couple minutes before we have to go to a break. I thought it was interesting. Cori Bush said, look, Joe Manson's talking about 3.7 or 3.5 trillion is too much. We want it to be $6 trillion. How in the world can Schumer and Pelosi bring these two sides together? Paul Plymouth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Perhaps they just need to get them back the room and really clash things out and say, you know what, we aren't leaving this room until we come up with something. But I forget who said this, but this just really shows the power of redistricting and also the power of representation. And the fact that we have a split Senate and we have a Congress that's pretty narrow, too, you're really increasing the power of one's voice when you have such close vote totals like that. So if it was 55 Democrats, 45 Republicans, you don't have to deal with some of the dissension of Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. You can deal with some of the heartburn that they may cause, but you don't need them at the end of the day. But now that it's 50-50, and now that it's what, 220 to 211 on the House side? It's so thin that you need everyone on board. And since you know that your voice is now really magnified, you have some that now more than ever, they really feel like their voice is being valued and they really feel like they have a larger seat at the table. So it's just a matter of getting those folks in the room. And it's like, look, we have until this date to get it done. I don't care how we get it done. We need to come up with something because the people really need this.
Russell Neverdon, we have a minute before we go to a break, so I'm not even going to have you start addressing this. But I want to know, Kara, I want to know if you all think that the real problem for the Democrats in these close House chamber and Senate, 50-50 in the House, I mean in the Senate, and it's even close, it's very close in the House. How in the world can progressives and moderates come together, or how can you make them come together in order to move a Democratic agenda? Be thinking about that, Russell Neverdon. You're listening to Two Way Talk. We're going to take a very quick break. It's Friday, and it's our roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Two Way Talk. It's Friday on Two Way Talk. Every Friday, we have our news roundtable. Kara, we have three lively Democrats on the show today. Jesse Mejia Terry, she's a Democratic strategist. Paul Plymouth is a much sought-after Democratic consultant. He is, I knew him at City Hall, an advisor to the City Council president at the time. And Russell Neverdon, an extraordinary attorney, Morgan State alumni, and a community advocate. They're joining Kara Williams and I today on Two Way Talk. When we went to the break, Russell Neverdon, I was asking, it seems to me, and you tell me, and I know you'll tell me if you think I'm wrong, as close as the Senate is, 50-50, obviously, and Nancy Pelosi has barely what? Is it a 7 or an 11 majority? It's close. They don't have to worry about the Republicans. They can't seem to keep the Democrats on the same page. And if they can't do that, if they can't find some common ground, Russell Neverdon, will they have any hope of moving Joe Biden's agenda forward?
Well, here's the thing, and you're right. It's a narrow margin that's there, and ordinarily we shouldn't even have to if we're unified and in concert with one agenda. It's a slam dunk. But the problem that we're having is, if you kind of look at what was going on, and again, it goes back to that social and that the affluent argument. If you looked at how that 3.5 was set aside, it really was about some real nuts and bolts about some social issues such as college funding, basically looking at the disenfranchising, giving us a foot in, if you will, to take a step up. The other side to that is why they wanted to do the increase was to say, okay, well, if we're going to do that and we're going to be taxing the wealthy, then we need to find another way to kind of backdoor and fund what we've taken out of them and reinvest in the corporate structure. And that's really what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are the moderate are still trying to find a way to still fund the interest of the affluent. And they're saying, we're willing to do it, but it's going to be a give and take. So the question becomes for us, which is why we have to become very, very involved and engaged with our political process, is what is it going to cost us to get the things that we really need and want for our immediate communities? Because there's going to be a price, and the question is it worth the price that we're going to have to pay on the back end?
I want to invite our listeners to join us today at 410-319-8888. That's the number to join our panel today. We're talking about the chaos in Washington, D.C. The political divides are deep on both the Republican and the Democratic side. Paul Plymouth, let me ask you, you're a self-admitted centrist Democrat. Joe Manson, the senator from Arizona, and others are saying, look, we have got to move slow and strategically, and we can't be caught to the purviews or the energies of the left in our own party, or we're in trouble. We're not going to be able to move Joe Biden's infrastructure bill or anything else if we can't get on the same page.
Yeah, what really disappoints me about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, they can have that position so long as they also come to the table with some solutions, with mm-hmm. some amendments. And they aren't really doing that. They're just saying, hold up, we need to take a further look at this. Hold on, we have some grave concerns. But you aren't actually coming to the table with some substance. And that's almost on par as what you'd get from the far right, like a Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz. You just wouldn't get some of their crazy antics that come along with it, too. But it's so unfortunate that we're at this point, that we're in this space right now. And you get very disappointed when you take a look at something like the voting rights bill hasn't passed.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, that takes 60 votes. You're taking a look at something like the For the People Act. Also, things that we would consider to be common sense measures, that hasn't moved along. But now we're talking about truly investing in people, and that hasn't moved along, too. We really ought to get people to come to the table with solutions. And it just really disappoints me that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, they continue to try and build themselves as true centrists and trying to be the last measure before just passing a wild agenda, or what they perceive to be a wild agenda, mm-hmm. that I think is perfectly fine to pass. They aren't coming to the table with enough solutions. They're just raising objections or saying, let's slow down. But, they aren't coming to the table with actual solutions, and that's a shame.
Jesse Mejia, I want to ask you, interestingly enough, Nancy Pelosi says she never brings legislation to the floor unless she's guaranteed a win. She announced a vote on the infrastructure bill, Biden's infrastructure bill, and then said there will be no vote. She obviously did not have the Democrats all on the same page. Is there any way there can be common ground, or are we going to see this happen over and over and over again? Not so much that we can't get the Republicans to get on board. We can't even get the Democrats to stay on the same page.
That's a tough one. let me see. I think this really is a reflection of the changing of the, I don't know how to say it, of the, of changing of the guard, really. I
uh-huh.
mean, it's a progressive bloc that is holding, you know, the Senate down and saying we want a progressive package. That's a 3.5 reconciliation package.
Uh-huh.
And the House, you know, breaking down, and I'm sorry, and the House wanting this package, and the Senate not being there with these two moderate Democrats, Sinema mm-hmm. and Manchin. And I understand that Manchin should be playing this game because he is in West Virginia, and you know he does. He is a, for all intents and purposes, he is a Democrat coming out of a red state.
Uh huh.
Correct. But Kyrsten Sinema, on the other hand, I mean, you know, she's only going to get primaried by someone that's obviously more progressive than she
is. That's right.
And there's no need for her to, this is almost, she's almost assuring her loss at this point with Democrats. I mean, just a few days ago, I think the Arizona Democratic Party said if she doesn't vote for the reconciliation package, that they would have a no confidence vote on her. And what does that mean locally? You know, all politics at the end of the day is local, and she is assuring her self-destruction with this, not saying what it is that she wants, what she wants. You know, there's nothing coming out of these two. And the thing about it, with Joe Manchin, he was flip-flopping on the numbers for several months, right? And he's still not there. But Sinema hasn't said anything, and there's no reason for this. So it is a tough task for the Speaker and the House and the Senate. That's, you know, but I think, you know, if we, I think that there is one light at the end of this tunnel, and that is that I think they should understand that this type of transformational spending, as they're calling it, they can leave a true legacy of with their name on this. And who wants to spoil the, you know, the Democratic president's agenda on this? So I think I am going to remain positive and say that they are going to get this done at the very last second. But it's going to get done. And if not, then there will be a reckoning, I think, with the Democratic Party
Russell,
moving forward.
Russell Neverdon, can you give, and maybe it's unfair to ask you to do this, can you give us any insight into what Kristen Sinema may be thinking? The Democrats in Arizona were ripping her apart, saying, look, you have been absolutely non-existent on these national issues, and now all of a sudden you are threatening to hold up President Biden's infrastructure bill. What is she thinking?
Well, it sounds to me like this is, again, this is more posturing. And so the biggest, for me, the biggest concern becomes, what is it that you're holding up for? Or whose interests are you really advocating? I mean, and that's really the underlying thing. It's because when you think about it, I think the spokesperson on behalf of Pelosi said, just leading up to when it, just before it was pulled, was like, hey, we're almost there.
We're
almost there. We are really, really close apart. So as you kind of alluded to earlier, that clearly there was some last-minute backdoor dealing that took place that kind of shifted things in a completely different direction. So I would be very curious as to what will be her support base after this, because when it kind of gets out there, like, look, these were some very germane issues that needed to be addressed, and here's the holdup. What is it that you're holding up on? I think it's still in the air exactly what it is. Like, what is the agenda in which she's trying to hold things up for? Are you really trying to hold up so that we're redirecting money back into, you know, because it really comes down to the taxation of the wealthy and how we're, that's where the trillions are going to come from. And so that's really, at the end of the day, that's what we're really looking at. And I think it's kind of a backdoor way to say, look, yeah, we're going to take it up front, but we're going to get it back on the back end.
I want you all to be thinking, because I'm going to ask you before we go to the next break and we lose you all, I want you to be thinking of a news item that you think is important but hasn't gotten very much play. Not a lot of follow-up, not a lot of talk about whatever is of interest to you in the news. I'll come to you and ask each of you to give me a news item that you think we should pay attention to. I want to change this conversation just a little bit. Jim Shea, the city solicitor in the city of Baltimore, who is the lawyer for the city of Baltimore, canceled an event that was scheduled to take place in the city of Baltimore, which had a lot of right-wing speakers coming to Baltimore, including Steve Bannon and others were about to speak. He cut it. He said, nope, not going to happen here. And now they are suing the city of Baltimore for canceling this event, calling it a question of free speech. And can the city of Baltimore shut down free speech? Paul Plymouth, who is in the right? Who's in the wrong here? Should Baltimore have cut that event that a lot of right-wing people were coming from around the country to the city of Baltimore to support?
Yeah, so this becomes so interesting, and it can be considered a very slippery slope.
Yes.
As you talk about free speech, certainly some would say that some of the folks that are organizers and were going to speak They have a history of using hate speech, and some of the folks that they would bring certainly attended the January 6th rally.
That's right. Yeah.
Either physically or financially or just in spirit. And given a lot of their, given their past propensity and disdain for a city like Baltimore, you can't have confidence that they can come and peacefully have their event without it also triggering a big spark, whether it's with counter-protesters or them just doing something bad. So I think if you look at it through that lens, it becomes more defensible than just, hey, we're looking to limit your free speech. We're really trying to look out for the city overall because we understand what riffraff that you guys can bring. And we understand the potential of what can come in the future.
You have to look at the protection of the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's already short staffed. We're short on emergency people for ambulance drivers, paramedics. We're short on police. Surrounding counties are short on police. So you have to look at that aspect. Who's going to protect the people of the city if these people do come and show off?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Now, Jesse Mejia Terry, I find it fascinating that we were shutting down this right-wing event that was scheduled for the city of Baltimore. But Democrats are the first to shout out in support of free speech. And shouldn't people who have very different opinions than most of us do in the city of Baltimore, but shouldn't they be allowed to come to Baltimore and speak their mind?
Of course they have that right. I don't think anyone is taking that
away.
You don't
sound very convinced to me.
I am not convinced that they are, you know, feeling their freedom of speech is threatened. I think they understand the dynamics here. They are a right-wing group with a certain, you know, philosophy of how they want the world to be that is no longer feasible, in my opinion. And they're coming to a predominantly black city that, you know, is right next door to Washington, D.C., where they demonstrated their capacity in January of this year. And so it's really, I mean, I understand the city's position on here because nobody wants any, you know, we've had a tough year. People are having a tough time, and it's really not conducive to growing an economy or any of that, which is what we need to be focusing on to get out of this, you know, COVID mess, for a group to come in and, you know, have the record of starting fights and getting violent, you know, at venues out in other locations. So I understand the city. I think that the city's, you know, the city and every other government will tell you that their number one responsibility is to secure the, you know, to make sure that its citizens are protected and are safe. And if you can't do that right, I mean, what are you doing? You know, so it's something that the city will continue to ensure that it's not, you know, that outsiders are not coming in to disturb.
Russell Neverdon, I know that you are a strong believer in the free speech of all people.
Absolutely.
Why would, now I didn't see a lot of African-American speakers on that list of speakers coming to this right-wing event. But shouldn't we, I guess I'm just trying to figure out, shouldn't we allow them to have their moment? Shouldn't they be able to come to Baltimore and preach what their philosophy is? I'm trying to choose my words very carefully here.
So let me put out the biggest disclaimer that I think everybody should be enlightened about. So the answer to that is yes. Should they be able to? The answer is yes. The question is it appropriate for them to come in? That leaves much room to be debated. And here's why. We know that we have, unfortunately, until we get a lot of our things straight or get our house clean, if you will, we are a potential powder keg. And when you think about it, here's the most beautiful setup. What better way to get and we still live in a city of two tails, because we still have a divided city where there's already some racial tension, there's some disparity issues, there's some investments in throughout communities. What better way to come in and bring an incisive type of circumstance where you know that people are already on the edge, and all it takes is the right word for it to go up, and now you've promoted their agenda. But here's the biggest piece. speech is not free.
Uh-oh.
Okay? Speech is not free, and here's why. Because throughout the Constitution, there are always restraints and mechanisms in place considered as safeguards. Under the freedom of speech, there are three categories that must be considered that will challenge and shut it down each time: time, space, and manner. The timing of it, and if we look at it just from a spatial standpoint, let's look at the tension that's already going on right now and what has just occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you talk about the place, which I just gave that scenario, the potential powder keg, and then the manner, how it's going to be delivered and what will be the potential content that could become incisive or explosive. And so the government has the absolute right to step in and say, when we consider time, place, and manner, it is in the majority interest of society as a whole that will always prevail over that of the individual's rights. And so that's where we are. Now, there are definitely going to be Democrats who come out, and I agree, people should be able to come out and give a speech and say whatever it is, and express their views, but there has to be some limitations when you look at those three factors. And in this case, I think Jim got it right.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly enough, Russell Neverdon, if I ever go to court, I want you by my side. I love how you choose your words ever so precisely. Now, interestingly enough, they are suing the city of Baltimore for millions of dollars for infringing on their right to speak, their freedom of speech. I doubt it's going to go very far,
right,
but it does raise a lot of questions and shines the light on the left and the Democrats for shutting them down.
Mm-mm. No, yeah. I don't think they should come.
I don't think that they should either. And I think that while the Democrats are, again, we have a divide.
Uh-huh.
There still is a fine line. And I always keep telling people, reminding them, we're still south of the Mason-Dixon line.
We sure
are. Let's be clear. You know, you can talk about you're in Maryland, we're Baltimore, we may not have as strong a southern accent as our D.C. counterparts, but at the end of the day, we're still south of the Mason-Dixon line. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe it, going down to the shore and see what happens. I'm just calling it as it is. But,
mm-hmm.
but we do have to be cognizant of the fact that we do still have some unresolved, unaddressed issues that have been lingering, and we keep throwing clouds over it. We have wonderful speeches. We have great marches. But at the end of the day, we still haven't gotten to the brass tacks of calling it for what it is and confronting those who are in positions of power to effectuate the necessary change. And so until we get to that point, there still need to be safeguards. And in this case, my biggest concern as a Baltimorean is, don't bring that nonsense here.
Mm,
and
right.
I think, and that's why I say that Jim did the right thing by understanding that, yes, in a different circumstance, in a different time, in a different place, in a different manner, that might be good, that you can go out and say exactly what you want to say. But we've seen what's happened when we went to South Carolina and watched what ended up happening with, you know, the beginnings of the Proud Boys and all those kinds of movements.
Mm.
Things can escalate from 0 to 60, and as one of the callers said, our resources are already depleted. Are we willing to take that chance and deplete our resources for chaos to completely erupt and we see our city in shambles once again?
Kara.
Well, you were talking about earlier in the conversation about just the whole world being in divisive now, but from the end of Obama's term up into the beginning of Trump's. But I really think that it started dividing when he announced his candidacy to be president. And then going into his presidency, you know, we kind of, they just began to creep out of the woodwork.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, at January 6th, now we've been fed. 4 years we fed the march of the meat, and now we want to try to give them crackers, and we can't do that.
Oh, wow.
So even with the people that would have been coming here on that talk,
mm-hmm.
we have people here that are like waiting for that. You know, I wish they would have came here.
Uh-huh.
You know, them kind of attitudes. So it's no sense in, like he said, letting that pot boil over
mm-hmm.
and bringing those people here. We already got people here who are just waiting for their chance, you know?
You have said it there. Let's go to the phones. We have a caller that wants to join us on Two-Way Talk. Tavon from West Baltimore, welcome to Two-Way Talk.
Yes, hi, good afternoon.
Hey there.
So I have some questions because as far as I'm from Baltimore, I lived in Baltimore probably most of my life, a couple years, moved out of town for college, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for the longest time, Baltimore has been under the thumb of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm by no means, first of all, I don't associate with either party because I know both parties don't have our best interests in mind. Some of them do, one party do a little bit to get our attention or to get on our good side,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. and the other do the same thing, and they constantly back and forth with each other. When they, at the end of the day, they all friends, they all whatever. But my thing is, Baltimore has not. It's always been divided, as far as I'm concerned. This country has always been divided. I would hope somebody tell me an era where there was united, where everybody felt equal or felt like they were a part of any decisions or anything was going on in this country. Now, there may be some times it may have felt that we were together, but that's few and far in between. But anyway, Baltimore has always been, as far as I'm concerned, the last 7 years, 2,100 homicides. That don't even count the shooting victims that survived. So the poverty is horrible here. The school system has always functioned as one of the worst school systems in the country, when right down in Howard County we have the absolute best public school system in the country. Mm-hmm. So how is it that one could get on here and say that, well, we shouldn't allow the Republicans to come here, which I don't think they would come here and act up, because if they know what I know, they wouldn't come here and act up. Like, but that's neither here nor there. And I'm not advocating violence, but if you say what you want about Baltimore, we're going to protect it. We will protect it. So, but I don't understand how someone could try to convince me that the Democrats are doing better than the Republicans for a city that's predominantly black, when black people are doing the absolute worst in this city.
Make good point.
Tavon, thank you for your point. Very sharp observations. Now, I think we have some other callers that are calling in. Let me ask you, Jesse Mejia, is there anything, Terry, let me not keep forgetting your last name. Jesse, is there anything that you've been reading in the news that has captured your attention that you think we should be paying more attention to?
Yes. The news today about the antiviral pill and that Merck has developed and that they're looking to expedite with the FDA authorization as soon as possible. I mean, it was such great news to hear. Finally, something else that we can use in the fight against this virus and get us into a more normal path. That brightened my morning, and I think I look forward to more information about this pill and what it does and how it does it, and hopefully it'll be distributed widely where there's a greater unvaccinated rate, so that people have access to life saving equipment and medicine. We need that.
Kara, I was very excited this morning when I heard about the possible oral medication for COVID.
Yes.
Merck is working hard to get the FDA to approve it. But you and I both know that we have callers who will give us 100 reasons why we should not be taking an injection, any kind of vaccine.
That's exactly what I thought when I read it. I said, oh boy, we're going to be bombarded with calls of why they don't want to take it, or why we shouldn't take
it. Why we shouldn't take it, yeah. How about you, Paul Plymouth? This is the first time you joined us on the roundtable. I'm excited to have you here. We've been friends for many years. Anything that has been in the news that has caught your attention but hasn't gotten any kind of big play or big attention?
Yes, certainly. And again, thank you for the invite, and I hope I hope after this audition I'm invited back again. I would say that the global supply chain shortage is still in effect. I think when it first hit people's newspapers and their ears, it was in the phase of lumber, so it's slowing down home production or any lumber that you want to get from a place like Home Depot. Also semiconductors or computer chips, and how it's slowing down production of electronics and even cars to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But it's even gone as so far as to create a global glass shortage too.
Wow.
And now there are talks of increasing the prices of a lot of goods and commodities that have glass in there, including but not limited to lamps, alcohol, wine bottles, just anything with a large component of glass in there, you can expect a slowdown in the production of it and possibly even increase the cost.
Wow, interesting. Russell Neverdon, any headlines that you think we should be paying closer attention to?
Absolutely. And I'm going to tell you very quickly because I know we're running out of time.
Yep, we're running out of time.
But Nick Mosby knocked it out the park. I salute that brother.
I believe charity starts at home.
Mm-hmm.
Get it? The minority participation or the lack thereof when it comes to these contracts and bids. We are a city known. We are the what they call the whore of development.
Ooh.
You come into Baltimore, you can take advantage of it, do all kinds of things you want to it, use it up, get these tax breaks, and then roll out and leave us.
And leave us high and dry.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And so if we're going to be doing development and meaningful things, why are we not hiring from within when we've got all these people who've got skills, who've got services that are just waiting to be used,
mm-hmm.
and they're being used and manipulated as pass-throughs? Nick hit it. I'm disappointed in city council for not pushing that through and making sure that that was a top priority agenda of trying to help enrich and empower others to be able to employ others of us to make a difference in this city.
Russell Neverdine, guess who our guest is in the next hour? We have Nick Mosby coming on. We're going to get into the nitty gritty. A lot of promises are made when it comes to minority contracting. A lot of those promises are not kept. And Nick Mosby's demanding that we keep those promises. We're going to talk about that in the next hour. I want to thank, and unfortunately we can't take any other callers, we're out of time, Jesse Mejia Terry, Democratic strategist. Thank you so much for joining us today on Two Way Talk.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Paul Plymouth, great to have you on. You passed your test. Can't wait to have you on again.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, guys.
Russell Neverdine, one of the greatest attorneys, one of the greatest citizens of the city of Baltimore. Thank you for being on the show with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure as always. Thanks for the
folks, we're going to go to Amy and get our MTA report. We'll be back for more two-way talk in just a moment.
Evening. Thanks. On Light Rail Link, we have the continuing.